Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with a really fascinating person. We've just been chatting before the show a bit, and you know, talk about intersections of food and art. I mean, it is your whole repertoire, you know, intentionally or not. Henry Hargraves, now a photographer, but that much more. Thank you for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So the accent, first of all, gives away that you're not from Brooklyn.
Yeah, I'm from New Zealand originally.
Yeah, in New Zealand, it was fascinating to find out of how much of a monoculture it is, how you know, almost solitary an island that nation is. Tell me a little bit about what growing up was like there.
Yeah, look, it's an amazing place to grow up. You have a lot of opportunities, it's safe, you know, it's beautiful as well. But yeah, that is the challenge. And everyone also always is like, oh, it's part of Australia. It's actually 4 hours flight from Australia. Yeah. So I'm always like, you know, it's Russia to England.
Yeah.
In terms of that. But you know, the closest foreign speaking country is Indonesia at 11 hours flight away. And, you know, and it's very, very like at school of our 600 students. I think it was, 590 young white boys.
Yeah.
A handful of Asians. And I think there was someone from Tanzania.
Yeah. I mean, so Samoan, Polynesian, are these parts of New Zealand culture? Or
you know what? New Zealand's is two islands, the North and the South Island. And the Polynesian population is, they're predominantly all in the North, because when the Maoris, when Polynesians first came, that's the warmer part.
Yeah.
In the South, the winters are a little aggressive when you don't have pink bats and insulation and things like that.
So Maori, not Samoan. And I kind of know it as rugby players, big old fellas.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's actually quite, as we grow up, because of course rugby's religion there, they actually do, you play by weight division, not age.
Yeah.
Because those boys develop, you know, they're like your father at 12.
Yeah. Well, you're spry, you're a tall, skinny man. Did you play rugby growing up? Was it part of the institution?
Oh, yeah. No, it was. And I had a career-ending hamstring injury when I was about 14, and then started playing golf.
Yeah. But you talk about those glory days all the time.
Oh, look, we do. I mean, and I used to play with the guy who lived across the road from me. We used to go out on the street and kick the rugby ball over the power lines to each other in the in the evenings before the sun went down. Yes. And you know, and I still religiously go and watch the All Blacks every time they play.
So, you know, New Zealand seems so idyllic when you explain that, and from what everyone's seen in Peter Jackson, you know, Hobbit films. But New Zealand is not Australia. What kind of exports, and how does it define itself as a nation outside of, you know, that island?
I mean, just sort of jumping back to the Australia thing before we even get into that, I remember a friend once said to me, you know, I've now figured out the difference between Australians and New Zealanders. She's like, it's like you take away the sort of the sophistication and you've got an Australian.
So I just lost all my Australian listeners after that. That's fine.
No, we love you guys too. I mean, we all know it's tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. But I mean, you guys, there was an interesting aspect to life where at a specific age, there was an overseas experience.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about when that happened and what that really was.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, jumping back to when you grow up there, you really don't have much of an exposure to other cultures. Everything's just this big exotic world that's a long, long way away. And so when you typically finish tertiary education, university, polytech, what have you, you do this thing called the OE, or the overseas experience. And often, because we're Commonwealth, all New Zealanders get a two-year work visa to the UK. So typically it involves, you know, just one-way ticket to London, working in, you know, for a couple of years, visa runs out, you're broke on the other side again, come back, and now time to start your life. But for me, I got my one-way ticket to London via Bangkok. And I went into Southeast Asia and spent 3 months traveling to kind of blow all my Pacific pesos, as they were calling the New Zealand dollar back in those days. And I actually got asked to model, because they didn't, in Thailand, they didn't have Western models going there as a destination because it wasn't well enough paid like Japan or Hong Kong or somewhere like that. So they would go around and pick up, get the tourists. So I was on Koh San Road, you know, shopping for a cheap bus ticket to Cambodia and got asked if I wanted to, you know, grace the lenses.
Yeah, well, I mean, tell me a little bit, because that sounds a little sketchy at first.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, what was that interaction like and why did you say yes? Why was it intriguing to you?
Well, also in New Zealand, the male, you know, the ideal male is a rugby player. He's not a high fashion model. You know, square jaw, big biceps and what have you. And we also don't really get the exposure to, or we didn't in the 90s, to high fashion. You know, there weren't Prada stores or Gucci or anything like that. It was, you know, very much the New Zealand and Australian brands with the All Blacks and the cricket players as the, you know, the guys wearing it. So I wasn't really aware there was this whole sort of, you know, heroin chic look going on in Europe. And so when I got approached, first of all, I was like, you know, really, me? You know? And then my sort of second thought was, you know, this all sounds very dodgy. It's got, you know, sort of rehypnol bathtubs and, you know, sore bottoms written all over it. So I treaded very carefully and said I would only do my little, like, test shoot for this thing, you know, around the area I was familiar with, and told a few people, and it all, you know, ended up being legit. And I ended up, you know, getting a few jobs on the back of this. And then went over to England and started working in a bar there, which bars had always been my traveling occupation. Wherever I went, I knew I'd be able to keep my head above the water financially by working in restaurants, and I'd done it at university. So I got to London and worked in a horrible place called The Railway in Putney, which is owned by J.D. Weatherspoon, which is the kind of Dunkin' Donuts of of restaurants in the UK. It's where you can go and get a full pub meal for £3.50. And so while I was there, I got my pictures from Thailand and actually decided I'd bite my pride and go to some agencies and see if anyone would represent me.
Yeah, I mean, so how long did it take for you to actually get a hit in London?
I went around. The first agencies I went into, the first couple didn't take me on, then one did. And you've also got to remember, for a young kid who was pretty modest and didn't really have that much confidence, it was a pretty hard thing to go and try and find a modeling agency, which is so much against, you know, that good New Zealand bloke. This is not, you know, what we do. But I thought I'd give it a shot. And, I eventually signed with someone. And a couple of weeks later, an agent from Milan came over scouting to bring people for Fashion Week in Italy. And then he said, look, I'll fly you over to Italy, take care of all your expenses, and come over for a month and see what happens. You know, you only have to pay for your eating. You know, everything else is taken care of. And basically, I went out there and got dealt four aces. I got all the big shows and, you know, was the face of Prada that season.
Well, that's pretty good. Yeah. And then you had the money to spend on good meals.
You know what? It's the male modeling world is not the female modeling world. It's diluted down massively, and I mean, look, it was great money for a 21-year-old, but it was going out pretty much as fast as it was coming in, and I wasn't being too lavish.
Yeah, Steven Meisel, Richard Avedon. I mean, you got to shoot with legends in the industry.
Yeah, I was really, really, really lucky that I kind of came in just at the right time, and then, you know, it was amazing to work with all those guys. And I also went in with a very concrete set of goals. You know, to me, it was about, I wanted to go and see a bunch of places. And by the end of it, I had 9 agencies around the world. So that was part of it. I actually never took an apartment while I was modeling. So I took a couple of sublets, but between gigs, I used to have Europe Lonely Planet on a shoestring. And it would be like, okay, I've got 2 weeks before I have to be in Paris. Let's go and see what these, you know, the Basque region's like. Let's go and see what, you know, the south of France and things. So I had this great, you know, travel experience with all of that and got to see everything. And also, one of the goals was, there were a couple of photographers I really wanted to work with. But once I got to a point, I wasn't really interested in the kind of the ride down for less prestigious, less money, kind of doing everything over again. Because that's the other thing about the fashion world is every 6 months, you do exactly the same thing you did 6 months before.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the food world sometimes. You know, it's the seasonality of you sit there and you wait for spring to happen. It's like, I want ramps. You know, I want garlic scapes. And then you wait a year again. It's like, yes, ramps. Yes, garlic scapes. And when does that cycle end?
Well, I guess I like the metaphor you're using there. And I think that the models are the food. You actually don't get to change anything. Whereas the designers are the chefs who actually get to have a bit more fun with it.
I really enjoy that analogy. Who is the photographer?
I'm thinking about the runway shows here and those things. The photographer was the guy I wanted to be.
Yeah.
So that's ultimately what happened for me. I was like, this is fun being, you know, being the guy having the pictures taken with, but God, I want to be the guy who makes the decisions here.
Yeah.
I want to be that kind of rock star behind the lens. So everyone listens to what he sort of says and, you know, talks about him in sort of, you know, hushed tones.
So, I mean, did you want to be a fashion photographer, the same ilk of who was photographing you?
I did film at university, and the only thing I realized when I finished that was that I didn't want to be a filmmaker, but I loved taking pictures, and my aunt had been the head of the art department at the sister school to where I went. So I used to go on the weekends and hit the dark room and develop my little pictures of the other, you know, of whatever I was taking pictures of. And I loved it. But in New Zealand, a photographer is not really a career. You know, the photographer is the guy who comes and takes pictures of school children. Not in a creepy way.
Yeah.
The school portraits. So I never really thought that there was that much of a world that it could happen in. So when I saw this, that was like, that's what I would like to do. And fashion was my first exposure. So I started trying to do that. But the first commercial jobs I started to get were for still life gigs and food, and I hadn't really expected that to happen. And when I started shooting that, I was like, you know what, I actually enjoy this a lot more. I don't really actually have that much of a vested interest in fashion. And it was like, for me, still life was, I could have a picture in my head of what I wanted something to look like, and the only variables are moving things around in light. It's not like styling and models, and you know, there's so much many moving parts.
Yeah, the control of an inanimate object.
Exactly. So that's what I really, really liked about it, and also working with Mizell, he had like such a vocabulary when it came to hair and makeup. You know, he could sit there and talk about all the different finishes and textures and this, and I was like, I'm like, give her smoky eyes and make her look great. You know, that was about the limit of that. So I realized I was never going to be able to reach those peaks of these guys.
Yeah. You know, it was fascinating you talking about your relationship with food in that sense, that you don't necessarily come to a shoot with the intricacies of how people cook or what ingredients are, because you like keeping those variables as almost abstract.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important for people to have their own unique perspective on things. And one of the things in food, I am really interested in the process, but I actually don't go out of my way to try and learn, you know, too much about that. I still like having that whole mystery and sort of still being the child that there's this wonderment that someone comes out with this fantastic thing. And, you know, I am genuinely blown away. I'm not like, oh, looks like he, you know, spent a little bit too much on, you know, that side with this here and, you know, he's under-seasoned it here or what have you. You know, to me, it's, I still go, you know, with these big wide eyes. And, you know, and also I don't follow too much of photography in general. I also do follow blogs very religiously, but I try to look into other avenues, so like the design blogs and architecture blogs and, you know, and restaurant blogs, as opposed to seeing what everyone else is doing in the photo world, because I find as a photographer you can get in that rut of, oh, I wish I did that, as opposed to like, here's something that I can interpret my own way.
Well, I mean, I look at your work and say, oh, I wish I did that. And, you know, even on your website, the playfulness of your name spelled in pancakes. I mean, you take such a wonderful childlike eye and turn it into, you know, that blur between high fashion and food photography. You know, you initially started photographing just plates at a restaurant. But when did that, you know, conceptual transition happen?
I think a lot of it came down to I did a stint as staff photographer at New York magazine, and I thought that was going to be my big break, you know, those big juicy credits that they give you. And when the first issue came out, I remember looking at my Google Analytics and being like, I'm going to, you know, this is going to really push the needle. And I was like, oh, I'm still getting a consistent 25 visits a day. Yeah. You know, nothing's really changed. And I did a series where we had a snowstorm here in Williamsburg, and I dropped Star Wars characters into these shots of everything, you know, stopped during the snow, and called it The Hipster Strikes Back. And anyway, long story short, it went viral. And so I was like, you know what? I've been thinking about this the wrong way. I've been waiting for cool things to fall in my lap when I really should trust my own instincts and do things I want to see. Because if I want to see it, someone else inevitably wants to see it, and it'll find its own audience. So that was kind of how it all started. And also, I think it's really important that when you go to a photographer's website, you can actually, I want to be able to see their ideas. And that's kind of what I try to do.
Well, I mean, let's pick apart your website for a sec, because it's not just your ideas. It's these collaborative, you know, projects, which is wonderful that you work with other people to mm-hmm. kind of expound, and it shows your hand and shows them. Let's talk about Caitlin Levin.
Sure.
And your relationship with her and how you two work together and what kind of work you make.
Well, so, I mean, for me, a lot of stuff also started with this place called Schiller's I used to work at, and Caitlin was a regular, came in on Monday night and would drink her rosé. And one day I was like, what do you do? And she said, I'm a prop stylist. So we went and did a couple of little shoots together, and we just ended up collaborating really well, because I feel like a good collaboration is, you know, you complement each other, and there are certain things that I'm not particularly strong with, and there are certain things that she's not, and we kind of worked really well together in that way. And then also, I think a good collaboration is also a conversation where you keep pushing each other and testing each other, and you don't necessarily have to have exactly the same aesthetic. And I think that's cool, where it becomes like this battle where it goes into a place where neither of you really expected it to go into. And that's kind of, you know, the magic of the collaboration, I think.
The gingerbread houses, the candy sculpture of mm-hmm. modern architecture, you know, using sugar, kind of like glass candy as the windows of the Louvre's pyramids. My favorite is the licorice windows of the Guggenheim.
Right.
I mean, how was that project concepted?
So that was Dylan Lauren from Dylan's Candy Store had come to me and said, look, I love what you do, and I'd love to just to do something with you guys. And they just opened up a new store in Miami, and it was Art Basel was coming up, and she said, look, why don't we give you the store to do an exhibition, great location there in Miami. And so as she was sort of saying, you know, have carte blanche, essentially, I was trying to think what would work there. And I was like, art sort of festival, candy store. Okay, let's do a marriage of these two. And so I was like, let's make gingerbread art galleries. And there was also the whole seasonal thing. And I actually met her at her brother's gingerbread making competition at his house. So I was like, this kind of tied in perfectly together. So I said to Caitlin, let's do this. And then she was like, well, how do you imagine we're going to make these things? And I was like, I have no idea. I've sold Dylan on the idea, so we're doing it. And now let's figure out how to make it happen. And, you know, neither Caitlin nor myself have really any training in the fine arts. Neither of us have, you know, done sculpture. I actually never studied photography. I never did any of these things. It's just like, we're just playing with food. We're like, there must be a way to execute this. And that's kind of our creative process. It's like, let's throw ourselves in the deep end. And that's what we did. And it was actually also interesting with these, because Dylan said, can we show the gingerbread galleries in the store? And I'm like, you know, this is like a film set. This is made for one view only.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one street town that you go around the back, and there's you know, the buildings are nothing.
Yeah, yeah. We have a specific point of view and an angle, and it's all a facade. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk bacon alphabets, setting food on fire, and so much more. You're listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Cheese Gainsburg by TaxStar on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel, here again with Henry Hargraves. And, well, we'll talk about 3D boobs in a second. See, now I got them hooked. Now everyone's wondering, what is 3D boobs? We'll get to that. But I want to talk a little more about Bacon Alphabet's caloric photography, setting foods on fire. How did these other projects come? Were these things that someone approached you, you approached somebody? How do these come to life?
I'm really, really lucky to start working with Stefan Sagmeister, this legendary art, you know, graphic designer, art director. And I've done many collaborations, a couple of campaigns, and also in his designer, Jessica Walsh, predominantly as well. And I was on set one time watching them do all this stuff with typography. And it was just so cool and so playful and so innovative. And I was like, I'd love to, let's throw my hat in the ring here and let's just try something out of food. And so I decided I'd do it out of bacon. It was like, you know, bacon's one of those things that, you know, there's that whole like cult of bacon that's going on at the moment. And, you know, where it tastes so good, but is also kind of like such a gross thing. But, you know, we've kind of convinced ourselves it's beautiful. And, you know, there's so many rights and wrongs going on with it. So I was like, let's do a bacon alphabet. And I decided to do it in the Old England font, and which is the one from the Times, and you know it's quite an interesting font because you know it was actually Hitler's favorite font and preferred font to use for all the mail outs. Yeah. You know the thing, it's got this like weird history. Anyway, I mean it was just, I mean that whole thing was just like let's show people bacon in a different way and let's show an alphabet in a different way. And to me, so much of my stuff is just like let's take two odds, let's smash them together, and let's see what the result is. And you know what? It often doesn't work, but I'd rather something doesn't work than not try it.
Yeah, I mean, at least it's tasty, that bacon. I mean, I'm sure you ate 26 pieces after that.
Well, it's also, this comes back to a little cultural thing. This is very much American bacon.
Yeah.
Like, when New Zealanders come over, they're like, what are these strips that are mainly fat? Like, we still get these cuts where it's, you know, 80% meat and a little bit of fat and rind on the side.
Is that streaky ham? Or that's a British thing, I believe.
Yeah, I've heard that term, but I wouldn't know what it meant.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So then setting food on fire, you know, you did a series where, what was it called? Burning Calories, where you literally just set food on fire.
Yeah, there was just, I wanted to play on that whole pun of burning calories, and the only literal way to burn calories, I was like, let's set it on fire. And a lot of my stuff starts where I'm like, with something I think will make a cool picture. And then I'm like, okay, now let's start to put the elements in place. And with this one, I actually did it with a friend of mine, Amira Kassim, who's got company called Flower Shop, and they make these amazing cakes. So I said to her, can you style this? And she said, well, I'll only do it if I can make cakes of all the fast food. So, you know, the popcorn, the Chinese noodles, the burger, everything is actually a cake, which almost looks like such a flawless piece of the real thing. And what was also interesting is the cakes actually have a similar caloric count to the real McCoy too, even though we think cakes are like these little like sugar bombs.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, that chicken chow mein is not being too light on your hips either.
Yeah, I mean, I love how it is these iconic things from Chinese takeout to, you know, hot dogs. But now I think I even love the level of it being cake. You know, these the fake food that you see out of, you know, outside of Chinese restaurants, Japanese restaurants, those plastic acrylic things. I mean, just removing it, that other sense, you know, elevates it in such a fascinating way. Jell-O Presidents. That's one where I just think, you're just having fun.
Yeah, that came about during the election. Of course, being a foreigner, I'm not allowed to vote. So you kind of, I just sit on the sidelines as this passive sort of viewer while this whole, you know, election mayhem's happening. And I wanted to do like an ode to the presidents. And so I decided to do everyone in profile, which had been that traditional sort of, you know, portrait of power. And I was like, let's do this out of one of those, you know, quintessentially American foods. So I was like, let's do these out of Jell-O, and then I'll color code them to which parties they were with, how many terms they did, how they died, if they died in office, you know, if they were impeached, like all these little things, and made this key and did a fun thing. And to me, when I sent those out on the internet, I also gave each president a fun fact, because I wanted it to be about learning as well. I kind of, it was a childlike, you know, thing to this. Like, you know, to me, it's one of those things, if you said learning about American history was the driest time of your time at school, it's like, let's have some fun, let's make it out of food, and let's give you something that you might remember because it's interesting. So, you know, Barack Obama collects Spider-Man and Conan the Barbarian comic books and, you know, showed it around to all these people. And actually, it was quite funny that I was interviewed recently by George Bush's daughter on the Today Show, and my George Bush fact was that when Bush moved into the White House, the Clinton administration had removed all the W's from all the keyboards, in the White House. Anyway, she's like, "That's untrue." That's anyway, it was reported in a lot of real, you know, newsworthy thing. So yeah. Who knows? I won't let the truth get in the way of a story. Also another thing. Yeah. To me, it was a fun anecdote.
So, I mean, was it farcical or was it an actual fact?
I mean, it was reported in, Google that. You'll see it's in, you know, I forget the newspapers, but big newspapers were reporting on that. And, you know, so, but I mean, big newspapers in China also write stories from The Onion.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, because The Band Writers, another great project that you've done, I couldn't tell whether or not, you know, these were real in that sense, too, because some of, you know, explain what a band writer is, first of all.
So when a musician plays a show, they have a writer, which traditionally was how they want their equipment set up. You know, we want these amps, we want the guitars set here, we want, you know, all these things. We want the space here so the musician, lead singer can, you know, mince around. And it got more specific to where it was like, I want this kind of food in the dressing room. And I found on this website called The Smoking Gun that people had actually scanned in all the riders and sent them in there. And so you could read what all these bands wanted. And initially I was thinking, I was caught by how wasteful a lot of it was. It was just like so much stuff that you know, there's no way on earth you can get through it all. So I thought I'd do a series based on, you know, showing how much waste they made. And I was like, well, no, I'm basically just going to be part of this. And, you know, it's going to be an exercise in spending money and then getting rid of it all. So, but what caught me was these interesting things that they were asking for. You know, Marilyn Manson wanting his Haribo gummy bears. His, you know, the Foo Fighters asking for a sausage that's so big it'll make a man feel self-conscious. You know, just these crazy, crazy things. And I was like, that's the interesting part, not how much stuff there is. So again, I did this series with Caitlin Levine. And one thing I also forgot to mention on collaborations, the other reason I love to do it is no matter how good I think I can make something, it'll be made better with a collaboration. Because I feel if I do something by myself, it's kind of like having a child. You never want to criticize it. You're always happy with what it does. But if someone else is involved, you can both, like, you know, you're not so attached to it.
Yeah.
So you can make it better. So we were discussing, we were like, let's do these like the Flemish still lifes, you know, where the themes are about the mortality and passing of time. And I thought this had a great connection with musicians, where as soon as the spotlight's, you know, gone off you, you're not going to be able to make these crazy requests.
Yeah, I love Lady Gaga's It's a Cheese Plate on Ice.
Yep.
No smelly, no sweaty.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way that how some of them reaffirmed what you thought about people, then some of them contradicted it, and then some of them were just plain cool, like, you know, Sinatra, who basically just asked for a booze buffet with shrimp and cough lozenges. It's like, you know, it's like, that's my priorities.
And what, Prince had an injection too, right? A B12 injection.
He wanted a doctor to administer the B12, so, you know, get a good hit of vitamins before he goes out to him. I mean, there was something also kind of tragic and Michael Jackson-y about that to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other one that was really kind of dark and tragic to me was Britney Spears, who, you know, along with McDonald's cheeseburgers without buns and her 100 figs and prunes, she wanted a portrait of Princess Diana. You know, which is just like, I wouldn't even try and decode that.
You mean
that.
You don't eat to a picture of Princess Diana? It's what all Americans do.
Yeah, maybe I should. You know, I've got a little collection of paraphernalia around my studio of things that have been left over from shoots. And that portrait is there, and it's actually too creepy for me. I'm actually kind of like initially just went face down, and now it's in a box somewhere. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I don't need to see that.
Well, it must be a wondrous Pandora's box of things that are, you know, stray around the studio, because you were asking me how I first found out about your work, and it was kind of a smattering, because you have such distinct projects that I think I've seen them here, seen them there, but I certainly remember your rainbow food collection. Mm-hmm. You know, as strikingly visual as that is, I'm assuming you probably have some rainbow food left at the house. But what was, you know, the reasoning behind that? Because for me, changing, you know, certain food items into this rainbow, decontextualize them, mm-hmm. one, and kind of put them in this funny, happy space that you don't really have to think. There's not too much depth.
Yeah, where that series came about was I read a little anecdote about a mother who had a child who was who didn't enjoy eating and was really, really struggling to get her son, I think it was, to eat. And so she said she started colouring the food to make it playful, and then he wanted to get involved with it. And to me, that kind of just jumped out of being like, isn't that interesting? As a kid, we want to play with food. We want it to be colourful. We want it to be fun. But as an adult, that repulses us. And to me, I was like, in food colouring, it's odourless and tasteless. But you have these preconceived notions. So I was like, let's make all this food that actually doesn't taste or smell any different, but just visually, we now don't want to see it. You know, yeah. it becomes not food in our mind, but, you know, the most exciting thing in the world for kids. And I just love how, as we grow up, we transition and allow, you know, our ideas change. And that was what this whole thing was to me.
It felt even about. More like, you know, those Play-Doh machines where you can make your own noodles. And, you know, whereas when looking at the spaghetti versus looking at a hamburger, in my mind now, maybe not as a child, those two things would taste the same because they're made of those same color. So it's just a really odd disconnection to, you know, being overloaded by color, being overloaded by this rainbow sensation. Mm. And it kind of like flatlined all food for me. I don't know if that was its you know, intent, but it was kind of a really interesting reaction that I didn't expect.
Well, I mean, I love hearing, you know, your feedback and people's reaction, because I also think that, you know, part of the trick to photography is to not give everyone all the answers. It's like, here's me giving you something. Think about it what you want. You know, it's like, here's a little bit of a mirror up to, you know, you can make your own, you know, conclusions as to what you think I'm doing. And I love hearing that when people run with things, the ball, much more than, you know, well,
I was really hoping you actually said conclusions because no meal, no seconds. Mm-hmm. These kind of portraits of the meals requested by death row inmates. Well, this obviously is a conclusion.
Yeah. And this and kind of Ban Riders, I think, are kind of sit nicely next to each other, because coming to the States, there's like one thing that, you know, from the other Anglo countries of the world, find really strange and surreal is the death penalty and this the way that this works. And this series came about when Texas was getting rid of the last meal request. Someone had ordered too much. They considered it too wasteful. So they were like, let's get rid of it. You're going to get what you're given. And that's that. And probably ironically spent, you know, millions in changing of, you know, legislation, which was much more than, you know, wasting a couple of fried chicken legs. But I was like, what do people actually have? And so I went online and found it's all public record. You can read about it. And it was sort of these things that their food kind of just gave you a connection with someone who you have no connection with. I was thinking everyone on death row, I thought of them as statistics. It was just a name. They were anonymous. But as soon as I saw what they requested, they actually became a person in my eyes. And also how the media has a way of kind of making killers celebrities. I mean, look at the Boston bomber who went on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. Mm-hmm. And this kind of became interesting with the Ban Riders as well, how these celebrities who we find you know, we put them on these pedestals, and but then they've got very common food tastes, and suddenly it's like, wow, they're not deities after all. And so with these prisoners, I mean, it was just interesting being able to relate for a moment to someone who I never thought I'd be able to relate to, and make you consider the death penalty and, yeah, you know, the implications and what have you. So, and with that series, I tried to give a spectrum of different people who are there for different reasons, and give a little bit of commentary, but not preach my own, you know, political tendencies. So I wanted to sort of throw in someone who's actually been pardoned after he was executed. I didn't realize that only 12 women have been executed versus like 3,500 men. You know, there are all these things I wanted to throw in. There's one guy who's disabled, and you never should be on death row, you know, if you're mentally disabled. But a lot of these people are there because they weren't able to afford good legal counsel. And their food often shows that, you know, it's what, you know, this kind of, for lack of a better word, like a white trash food, which we know as comfort food. Yeah. And that became so spooky, comfort food.
Yeah, nothing was lavish. I mean, lots of fried chicken was a recurring, you know, food theme. White breads, sodas, you know, pop. There were two that really did stand out for me, though. Mm-hmm. One, the single olive, mm-hmm, which I'll let you explain more, because the reason why that person chose that is kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah, so there was Victor Feuriger, and he what I liked about that was he was one of the few people, I think, who tried to make a statement, like give some symbolism. And the olive, of course, is a symbol of rebirth and new beginnings. And I like the way he used his last meal as a kind of, you know, to almost say, I feel like he was almost saying, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it felt remorseful.
Yeah.
Whereas the no food one didn't. Who was it that, you know, there was a blank tray?
I think it was Anuel Diaz. Forgive me, I don't have all the names in front. Yeah. It was a few years ago since I did this. But he said he didn't want anything, and then something was given to him, and then he said, actually, I don't want anything at all. Which, contrary to that, I feel like if I was ever in that position, eating food would be the last thing on my mind. You know, so I kind of can relate to that as well.
Yeah, I would like to eat a key so that I can escape from these shackles.
Everlasting gobstopper.
Yeah. You know, aside from these kind of, you know, I know you're saying you're not alluding to an answer, and you're trying to keep them open-ended, but there's a very specific point of view in all the things that you do. And what's kind of an amazing point in your life is that you've actually taken that and converted it into a living space too, because you're a partner in a couple of restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you take those same sensibilities of how you shoot, the playfulness, the, you know, interpretive ideas and space into these restaurants?
I mean, I always loved working in restaurants, and it was one of the hardest decisions to make was to stop. And I had to do that because working at night, your body kind of gets revved up at night, and during the day is kind of like flat. It's like building up slowly, and I couldn't successfully shoot during the day and work in bars and restaurants at night. But I didn't want to miss this excitement and this, you know, interest I had in restaurants. So, I was privileged enough that I got to a position where I was able to, you know, help out a couple of friends who started places. One of them was my friend Dean, who was the maitre d' at Schiller's when I worked there, who started Jack's Wife Frida in Soho. And the other is my friend John McCormick, who I'd been a big fanboy of his restaurants for a long time. He's got Moto and Design Five Leaves and Maison Premier and stuff. And he started St. Maisie, and I was able to get in on that as well. So I try not to... I want it to be their restaurant very much, but so when I go there, I'm still more of a fly on the wall. But I just love to be involved however I can and hear the stories and how everything's going and running. So that's more that. I try not to step on their vision.
Pavlova, does that exist at St. Maisie's?
Unfortunately not. You've got to go to Five Leaves for that one.
Yeah.
Or come to my dinner table.
Yeah. Well, those Australians don't really own Anna Pavlova. That is not their dessert.
Absolutely. You get in a lot of trouble claiming that to a New Zealander.
Well, I'm bipartisan. I'm that impartial jury. I love New Zealand and Australia the same.
But for those who haven't had it, it is an experience.
Yeah. Lastly, you were talking about these food maps.
Mm-hmm.
A new project you're doing that you have yet to release, but corn is the U.S., New Zealand as the Kiwi. Tell me a little bit more about this, because I'm excited to see this coming out.
So I'm doing this also with Caitlin, and we just decided we would. I mean, I love reinventing iconic images. You know, take subway lines, for instance, and let's make those out of spaghetti and M&Ms. Let's, take a portrait and let's create it out of ketchup. And with these, it was like, let's take a map and create it out of food and break it down politically, and also challenge ourselves with, how many different things can we do with corn? So for the states, we did corn. It's like, okay, we've got to come through 50 different ways of making this for each state. With New Zealand, it was, I think we've got 14 different states and regions in New Zealand. It was like, let's take a kiwi fruit and dice it each different way. So it becomes this like kind of fun thing. But then it becomes so beautiful when you step back and you look at this food making something that you never expected. And I love turning it on its head and taking your expectations of what, you look at food, you think of food and it's like, get in my belly. And it's like, no, let's use it to tell a story. Let's use it to make something beautiful. Let's use it to surprise you. And that, I guess, is kind of the genesis of what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave everybody with a surprise, because I'm not going to tell them more about 3D boobs. That's 3DDD boobs.
Just three, two Ds.
Two
three,
Ds.
Three double D.
Three double D boobs.
I always like to say that there's four cornerstones to my work: childhood nostalgia, food, bright colors, and breasts. and everything seems to be a combination of those four.
Yeah, I'd love to see what you do with chicken breasts in there. You've been listening to the Food Scene at Heritage Radio Network. .org. Please go to Henry Hargrave's website, check out all his fabulous work, and we're excited to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Until then, cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.